This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March the 30th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPE. It's intended for your own personal use and any other use of this broadcast without the express written consent of Nichols Patrick CPE Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs is prohibited. Now let's go ahead and start taking a look at what's going on this week in the area of federal taxes. We're going to start out first with a Chief Counsel email. And this is Chief Counsel email 2015-13-003 issued on March the 27th. And this deals with the interesting issue about when a taxpayer can claim a deduction for payments made as part of what was a deferred prosecution agreement. In this particular case, the taxpayer had entered into a deferred prosecution agreement with the Department of Justice. They were going to pay a certain amount of money to the Department of Justice, and under that particular payment scheme, they were going to essentially pay it in lieu of forfeiture for either civil or criminal forfeiture of the gains they had received from the transaction in question. The taxpayer argued that this was an ordinary and necessary business expense and should be deductible under Section 165. The Chief Counsel email concluded that, in fact, it was going to be blocked by Section 165F. What Section 165F says is no deduction shall be allowed for any fine or similar penalty paid to a government for the violation of any law. So under that rule, while 162 says ordinary and necessary business expenses are deductible, if in fact that ordinary and necessary expense is a fine or penalty, then the payment's not allowed. Now, the taxpayers said the Department of Justice had indicated that these funds that were going in were going to be dispersed by the DOJ to the victims of the fraud to get them back to being whole. And so what the taxpayer claimed was essentially that, well, this is just, you know, returning income we previously recognized. We should get a deduction. And because it's in that nature, instead of a fine being paid to the government, that we should be able to claim the deduction. The taxpayer argued and pointed out two things. First, they said, we had not pled guilty or no contest in any court proceeding. And the payment was earmarked by the Department of Justice for the restitution of victims. So as such, they believed that they should be able to get the deduction. Now, the IRS email takes a look at both points. It argues the first point is irrelevant, because Treasury Regulation 1.162-21B1III talks about any settlement of a taxpayer's actual or potential liability. So we don't need an admission of guilt or a taxpayer's admission or even a taxpayer's non-admission with a no contest plea that we're not going to say that we are or are not guilty. They do not have to essentially have in any way, you know, come out and said, yeah, you know, we might be guilty. They simply have to have entered into a settlement. Having entered into that settlement, if that settlement is in the nature of a fine, then the IRS national office position is that that's non-deductible. And what the Department of Justice is going to do with the funds, it says, was not relevant. Rather, the memo concludes the terms of the deferred prosecution agreement should control this. The DPA specifically states that the payment is in lieu of criminal and or civil forfeiture, which would have been penalties under the provision. It's a negotiated settlement, it said, that the taxpayer specifically requires a forfeiture payment rather than requiring the part or all the payment be allocated as restitution. The national office's position is if you wanted to take it as restitution, you want to try to claim a restitution payment, then you should have negotiated for restitution specifically, not simply given it to the Department of Justice and left it up to their discretion as to whether or not the payment would be a restitution. You should have had a direct restitution payment, not a payment through the DOJ. The fact that DOJ had stated that their intention was to pay it to the victims is not relevant in the view of the IRS. Now, interestingly enough, the memo ends with a reference to briefs the Chief Counsel's office had filed in another case of Nacchio versus United States, 113 AFTR 2nd 2014-1288, which was a court of claims case. That reference is somewhat interesting because if you go back and take a look at that case, you're going to discover that the IRS actually lost in that case. But in that case, the taxpayer was claiming that the payment was basically restitution, and under a claim of right doctrine, they should be allowed the deduction. The declarative claims allowed the claim of right to go forward under Section 165, which was a loss. And so presumably we're kind of looking at this from the standpoint that these guys were arguing, nope, this did not claim to be a restitution payment. As such, since it was not a restitution payment, NACHIO also arguably shouldn't apply, is probably going to be the view of the national office. But I found it interesting, that case came down against the service in March of last year. This memo, while released this week, was actually originally issued, this email was back in last October. That takes a while for them to go through, redact everything, and get them issued. So it just came out now. But nevertheless, the Department of Justice, I should say, the person writing the email presumably was aware that the IRS had lost on that case, nevertheless still cross-referenced over to it. Interesting aside. In announcement 2015-13, paper filing comes back to the forefront. In fact, the IRS now is going to mandate paper filing. Interesting issue, right? As we've been in the e-filing period. In announcement 2015-13, the IRS announced, kind of late, how to handle 2014 tax returns with airline employees who are attempting to take advantage of a provision Congress passed in late December. Now, in 2012, Congress had passed the original provision that was going to be dealt with in the 2014 late act. As part of the FAA Modernization Reform Act of 2012, it allowed airline employees receiving payments from an airline that was in a bankruptcy case filed after September 11th of 2001 and before 2007 to basically take part of any settlement payment they received from the airline that would be included in their wages for claims they potentially had against defined benefit plans that had been maintained by that employer, and allowed them to roll over 90% of that amount and take it off the return into an IRA. Under that particular rule, for 180 days, they could transfer that 90%. Prior relief had allowed employees to transfer those payments to a Roth IRA. They paid tax, but they could put it in the side fund. If it's left in the Roth IRA, it would never be taxed on the outside. If an employee had done that, they were given the 180 days to transfer up to 90% of what they put in the Roth IRA and get a deduction for that. Now, one problem was, of course, that stopped in 2007. Last year, Congress extended the relief specifically to deal with the American Airlines bankruptcy and a similar payment mechanism in that bankruptcy case. And when they did that, they extended the relief and they opened up another period in this case. So in this case, we have a new filing period. So one of those issues, and it becomes very much, is a bankruptcy case filed on November 29th, 2011. As you might guess, that happens to be the date of filing of, yes, the American Airlines bankruptcy, and opens up a transfer again. But one problem Congress had in this case, under the original law, the airlines were supposed to file a report with the IRS. In fact, they still file a form. That form, which they filed with the IRS, basically told the IRS how much of the payment they had made to the employee was a qualified payment under these rules, so how much could be excluded from the employee's wages. While Congress extended the rule about allowing the employee to roll over, Congress did not extend the information reporting. So the Form 8935 that had been used before for the report is not required from American Airlines, since American is the primary one impacted by this, to be filed for these newly eligible employees. Therefore, the IRS has announced for affected employees, if you have employees who are affected by this, this is something now to take note of, they must file a paper Form 1040 for 2014. They still include the wages on page 7, but they must put an adjustment on line 21 and must basically attach the statement as mentioned in this particular announcement. So if you have an employee impacted by that, you want to go get announcement 2015-13 and follow it. The IRS further announced that for anybody who gets this payment in 2015 or later years, they'll give announcements in the future about what they're going to do in 15 returns. But for this year, anybody that wants to take advantage of this particular program is going to have to paper and not electronically file their tax returns. That is what announcement 2015-13 told us with regard to these employees. Next up, we have the case of Lamas versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-59. The 2008 financial crisis has turned out to have given us a couple of interesting cases with regard to passive activity losses. What happened in the case, and this is a follow-up, we had talked about earlier about another case where a taxpayer, in this case an individual who had retired, left the kids in charge of the business, then had to come back in 2008 because when the economic crisis hit, they couldn't get funding, people were worried, they had to come back, and he had to come back, get the funding, get the company back on its feet, and do that work. And that the IRS had claimed, well, he really wasn't materially participating at that point. That case came in favor of the person stepping in. This is another case that's not, in this case, dad stepping in. This is minority owner brother stepping in. In the case of Lamas versus Commissioner, it was an interesting family. In the family, we had basically three corporations. Dad had run a very successful company. Dad went ahead and formed three companies, which he would use to be able to essentially handle or run businesses for the kids. Mr. Lamas was a 20% owner of one of the entities, and his brothers or sisters were, and basically two sisters, I should say, were also owners. So they each had a majority interest where they controlled 60%, and then they had minority interest of 20% each in the two companies. So in this case, Lamas versus Commissioner, we have this guy. He was a 20% owner of a company. This particular company, which he was a 20% owner of in this case, was a company known as Shomas. The problem in this case was that with the economic downturn, Shomas ended up having lots of financial problems. Shomas was a developer, and it needed lots of financing. It was trying to run a condo project that was called, basically, the greens at Doral, referred to in the case as greens. In this particular case, where we have this particular problem, we have basically these two particular interests where they come in and run this. Mr. Lamas, well, a couple things happened. Number one, the majority owner of Shomas, Mr. Lamas and his other sister, who was not the owner, in essence, the majority owner, her husband, basically Mr. Lamas's brother-in-law, had been apparently, in the view of Mr. Lamas and his other minority owner sister, been mismanaging the company, misusing the company, and misappropriating funds. So they had a lawsuit against him. Mr. Lamas spent plenty of time in that lawsuit. He also spent time trying to find funding and trying to find various investors or potential purchasers for projects that Shoma was running. Now, the IRS claimed, the taxpayer claimed he materially participated. This is important because this thing generated multi-million dollar net operating loss refunds for the taxpayer for the year 2008. Therefore, obviously, the IRS is going to claim, wait, no, it's a passive activity. Part of this occurred probably because Mr. Lamas and his brother-in-law had this little tiff. The brother-in-law had initially supported Mr. Lamas's contention that he had worked more than 500 hours in the projects. However, when the case continued to go against the brother-in-law changed his story and told the IRS, no. Turns out Mr. Lamas had not worked those hours. Therefore, the IRS concluded, or the return concluded, because he had not worked those hours, he could not have been materially participating. Well, it turns out that was not exactly how things were going to work for this case. First issue we came into was we had these two separate activities. We had Shomas and we had Greens. Greens was an LLC where the ownership was identical to Shomas. So our first question is, do we combine the hours of Mr. Lamas with Shomas and with the Greens, or do we treat them separately? The tax court decided, because the IRS had come down and concluded, or I should say the taxpayer had argued that we should be able to combine the two, the tax court decided to take a look at the combination, and they agreed upon it. They said it was an appropriate economic unit based on the facts and circumstances. You'll find that the question of what you can combine is found in Regulation 1.469-4C2. And that tells us that we test this on facts and circumstances. But in determining those facts and circumstances, we looked at the similarities and differences in the types of trades or businesses, the extent of common control, the extent of common ownership, the geographic location, and interdependencies among the activities. The tax court found that all of these argued in favor of them. Both entities were real estate businesses. They both had common control and common ownership. They shared the same office buildings, so they had the same geographic location generally and very specifically. And they were interdependent because employees of one worked for the other. They're managed out of the same office. They're interdependent activities. So the tax court concluded that based on that, Mr. Lamas had put in over 500 hours in the combined activities. But the IRS wasn't done yet. Now remember, 500 hours is one of the automatic provisions. If an individual participates in activity for more than 500 hours during the year, that means it's considered to be material participation. But the IRS said, no, he participated primarily as an investor. Now under Regulation 1.469-5TF2II, if you participate primarily as an investor, any work done as an investor doesn't count towards your hours unless the individual is directly involved in the day-to-day management or operations of the facility. Now, this is where the brother-in-law claimed that Mr. Lamas was not involved day-to-day. Or I should say, he claimed that at the very end. He had earlier claimed he was. The IRS said, aha, Mr. Lamas, therefore, is an investor. See what his brother-in-law says. Well, the tax court took a look at this and decided that they did not find the brother-in-law to be believable. What was the problem? Well, a couple of things were the problem with the brother-in-law. First, the court pointed out that obviously his story changed when the other case went against him, so he had a reason to be upset at the taxpayer. The court also noted that his testimony was contradictory. He claimed Mr. Lamas had nothing to do with the company. Nevertheless, he admitted that he had been involved in negotiating various deals. It's like, wait, having nothing to, doing absolutely nothing in 2008 and then being involved in these significant deals, well, that seems to be highly contradictory. It seems like he's coming to a conclusion that did not make sense. Also, they said Mr. Lamas's testimony that he had been involved for many hours was supported by the testimony of other witnesses. Also, phone records supported the fact that Mr. Lamas had made all of these calls and was in contact with these people, were involved with Shoma. All of this corroborated Mr. Lamas' testimony. Because of that, the court found that Mr. Lamas was believable, and they accepted the fact that he had been involved in the day-to-day activities. They pointed out, too, that in the last half of the year, he was made treasurer of the company and became a corporate officer. Another interesting fact, when the brother-in-law says he wasn't involved at all, and he was given an office in the building. Again, the court said it seems difficult to reconcile that with the brother-in-law's statement that he was not involved with the company at all in 2008. Apparently, he missed that little part where they agreed to put him in as a corporate officer. So the tax court found the investor rule did not apply. Well, the IRS had one other way to try to get out of this. That was, they argued under Regulation 1.469-5TF2I, that he had performed work not customarily done by owners, and you don't count any of those hours in attempting to figure out his hours. Now, it's not clear from the court's decision what part of what he did the IRS did not think was work normally done by the owners. What was clear was the court found that all the work he had done to find owners or to find buyers and to find investors and find funds were related to the core business of this enterprise and its huge need in 2008. And because of that, all of his hours count. Because all of his hours count, the tax court found that, basically, he was considered to be materially participating. Finally, let's take a look at the case of Smith versus Commissioner. This is Tax Court Memorandum 2015-60. And it's a collections case. It was issued on 3/26/15. In this case, here's what happens, and we're not going to worry too much about the collections side of this, except for one side issue. The taxpayer received a trust fund penalty assessment. The taxpayer's position was for 2009, the taxpayer took the position, and let's assume it's true for this point, that in fact he had resigned and left the partnership in January 1st, 2008. So not being a partner in 2009 or being involved at all in 2009, he could not be a responsible person. Now, he received this letter from the IRS, where we received the letter 1153, the Trust Fund Recovery Penalty Letter. And when he received that letter, he sent a copy, faxed it to his CPA. The CPA, in November of 2010, claims, and this is where our issue is going to come at this point, that he wrote a letter to the address specified in that letter asking for specifically an appeal. The letter 1153 gives you a right to ask for an administrative appeal prior to the IRS taking action to levy against you for the trust fund penalty. Now, it appears they never heard anything more after that. In the letter, he stated that I want an appeal, and this gentleman was not a partner in the partnership at that time. 2 years later, the IRS sends the taxpayer a notice of intent to levy. So they're going to go against his property. So we go down that. The taxpayer asked for basically a hearing on the collections issue. Now, in the hearing at the collections issue, the CPA shows up again and says Mr. Smith was not a partner. The IRS at this point says, wait, this is a collection issue. In essence, the tax has already been assessed. And under Section 6330, if the taxpayer had already had the right, to protest the tax and failed to protest it, you cannot raise the question of the validity of the collection, the validity of the assessment in this particular session. The CPA says, oh, no, no, we sent that letter. We asked for our rights and we never heard anything. The IRS took a look through their files, found nothing. The CPA looked through his files, sent a copy of the letter to appeals for the collections case, and then said, and on the note said, oh, by the way, and said we were unable to find our certified mail receipt. At this point, the IRS rules that, in fact, our records don't show we ever received it. There's nothing else there. He had the right to protest. The time expired. He failed to do so. Therefore, we cannot raise this issue. This proved to be a problem because the taxpayer's representative, the CPA, also decided not to raise any other issue. The tax court decided in TC Memo 2015-60 that they did not believe, the court came to the conclusion that in fact the CPA, the taxpayer, had been unable to prove that there was a timely filing of a petition, or should say a petition, timely filing of an appellate request. The court noted that the CPA testified that he wrote the letter and then he gave it to the people in his office to mail through mail procedures. Nobody ever testified from his office that they had actually mailed the letter. The court found that interesting. The court also noted that normally he would have known it was an important document. He would have known, sent it certified normally. And because of that, he would have, you know, kept the receipt. The fact he couldn't find one and the fact he even kind of admitted in his facts that he couldn't find one suggests that to the court, that as far as the court was concerned, they concluded that they had failed to show that there had ever been a filing done. Therefore, he had had a right to appeal, their right had expired, and therefore he now had no right to challenge the underlying assessment in the collections action. This turned out to be doubly bad news because the CPA, in representing him in the collection action, appeared to put all his eggs in one basket, and according to the court, raised no other collection alternatives. So now the guy is apparently, since we can't challenge he owes it, and we've given up our ability to challenge whether we can negotiate some reduction or even an offer in compromise based on doubt as to liability, now we suddenly have a problem. We have an issue in dealing with this. So this proves the importance of making sure you follow through on things like getting things mailed and getting evidence and getting that certified mail receipt into the file. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March the 30th, 2015. Be sure to join us next week for more developments. And also go to our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We have additional discussion of these cases, plus we have links to the cases. And if you wish to comment, you can comment and carry on a discussion there if you have questions or issues. So again, go to currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Look forward to seeing you again next week when we talk about the new developments in federal taxes.